Welcome to this podcast brought to you from the Small Wonder Short Story Festival 2013. A big thank you to the Charleston Trust, who have joined forces with Threshold, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, to record these special discussions on the short story form. I'm Catherine Orr, and I'm very happy today to be talking to the writer Jane Rogers about her collection of short stories, Hitting Trees with Sticks, which was recently published by Comma Press. Jane is Professor of Writing at Sheffield Hallam University and has written 8 novels, including the Man Booker longlisted, The Testament of Jesse Lamb. So thank you so much, Jane, for agreeing to talk to us today.
Thank you for asking me.
And thank you for agreeing to open with a couple of short readings, the first from Morphogenesis and the second from Hitting Trees with Sticks. Possibly the first page of Morphogenesis, if you'd be happy with that.
I'm fine
just
with that.
Just by way of introduction.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. So, Morphogenesis, which is about Alan Turing. He's 10 years old, hot, with itchy grass seeds sticking through his socks. The glittering lock lies behind him. Up here he's surrounded by a sea of purple heather. He's come to a standstill by the Bothy, which is at the intersection of 52 B flight paths, and now his body is pinging his still-computing brain with messages, lungs gasping for oxygen, left heel sore where the new shoe rubs, ears tuning in to the intensifying buzz, eyes scanning. Yes. Fix on the crack beside the corner post, where bees are alighting, crawling in, crawling out, taking flight. It's at shoulder height. He can get the honey easy. As he watches their angular dances, the thudding of his heart recedes and his bladder gives a plaintive twinge. Unbuttoning his flies with his right hand and grasping his penis with his left, he aims at the base of the corner post, drilling a hole in the dust with his pee splashing darkly up the wood. The hot ammonia smell rises intensely for a moment, then mingles with the heather and dust, dilutes, diffuses, fades into the summer air. When the pea has evaporated, it will leave that little ridged circle in the dust, which it has turned to mud, like a volcano crater. It was part of him, that pea. Cells from inside him will be left there in the mud. And when it dries completely, and the dust gets blown by the wind, and a speck of the dust falls to the ground by this heather plant, and the heather drops a seed which sprouts from that dust which was partly made by his pea. Will the heather have his cells in it? Will the honey made by the bee who collects the pollen from the flower that has grown from the pea dust? And if he came back and ate that honey, would a bit of it recognise it had come home?
So before you read the next extract, just while Morphogenesis is fresh in our minds, one of the things that really interested me was reading a comment you've made about structuring the collection and how you'd chosen to alternate first person and third person narrative. And it struck me that Morphogenesis, which is a close third person, actually opens in a way which isn't dissimilar to Hitting Trees. So the way that as a writer you're getting into character is comparable, and I wondered if for that reason we could just listen to the opening of Hitting Trees as maybe a way of discussing the difference in, but they're very, very different projects as short stories, and I thought that might be an interesting way to start talking about the process of approaching a new project and two projects which obviously had, well, seemed to me to have very different starting points.
They did have very different starting points. I mean, I'm interested that you think that they are similar ways into character, because I hadn't actually thought of that. But I mean, one of the things about writing is that every time you start a new story, every time you start a new novel, you reinvent the wheel.
Yes.
And no matter what clever tricks you've invented in the past, they completely fly out the window and you have to sort of start from scratch again.
Yeah.
So a reader will say, oh, you know, you're covering similar territory or you're using a similar technique, and you think, no, I'm not. I had to start from the beginning all over again.
It wasn't planned. Like
it wasn't planned like that. But certainly I'm happy to read the beginning of Hitting Trees with Sticks to make the comparison that you've pointed out. Okay, Hitting Trees with Sticks. As I am walking home from the shops, I pass a young girl hitting a tree. I should say she's about 10 years old. She's using a stout stick, quite possibly a broom handle, and she's methodically and repeatedly whacking the trunk as if it is a job she has to do. There is a boy who stands and watches her. The tree is Prunus sapientella, flowering cherry, growing in the strip of grass that separates the pavement from the dual carriageway. I know that when I speculate about such things, I'm on treacherous ground. But as I look at her, I do have a flicker, like the quick opening of a camera shutter, of Henry crouched on the bonnet of the old green Ford, bashing it with a rock. We were at the farm then, so he must have been 9. The flicker is not so much of what he did, because of course I remember the incident perfectly well, as of my own furious older sister indignation. Watching the girl today, I feel simply puzzled. So many things are puzzling. The only thing that is certain is that I cannot trust myself to get it right. That flicker of indignant fury runs through my veins like a shot of cognac. Wonderful. I can walk on with a spring in my step. Hitting trees with sticks makes me think of the way they sometimes feed remains of animals to the same species. Pigs, for example. Hitting the poor tree with wood, making it beat itself. It's against nature. It adds insult to injury. But maybe I'm missing something.
Thank you. So what I'd like to start with is this question of, and this is a question for any writer, not just a short story writer, but how one really inhabits another person's mind and being in the world. And I think in both of these openings, you do that brilliantly, but with very different material. And I know from listening to you talk about hitting trees before, that that was a story that came very quickly for you. Mm. That's right, isn't it?
It did, yeah. Yeah.
And morphogenesis, I'm speculating, because it would have involved research,
yes.
Could not have been quite such a swift
process. It was really hard.
So yeah. The genius of the opening of morphogenesis is that you managed to achieve that sort of swift jump into a character while you're grappling with research. And I know from my own work that that can be quite cumbersome to deal with, that having saturated your mind with a lot of research, you have to somehow filter it, absorb it, put it to one side. I wondered how that worked for you.
Yeah, I really struggled with morphogenesis. It was a commissioned story, which I don't, I don't often get. You don't often get commissions to write stories, or I don't. And it was for an anthology of stories about important moments in science, which was commissioned by Ra Page of Comma Press. And I chose the Turing moment because I had read a wonderful biography of Turing by Alan Hodges. And, quite apart from being, a remarkable mind, Alan Turing the man really fascinated me. But, I'm not a scientist, and I actually find the concept really, really hard. The concept of morphogenesis is one of those things where I can understand it for a bit, and then I kind of forget how to understand it. It's on the edges of my comprehension. Yeah. I sort of knew what I wanted to do, but I couldn't find a way into it at all. And I very much like to use first person, but it felt extremely arrogant and inappropriate to attempt his first person. I can't do that. So I did the next best thing, which is a close-up third person. And what I needed to find was a moment that was entirely within my experience,
yeah.
I think, so that I could find my way into his way of thinking. And just thinking about the kind of mind who sees everything in the world as a mystery and a puzzle to be solved, which is clearly the scientific mind.
Yeah.
To him, as a child, everything is a puzzle to be solved. You get that from the biography. I mean, it's completely clear. It's an extraordinary curiosity, a burning curiosity about what makes everything work.
Mm.
And Hodges simply describes him enjoying going up to Scotland on holiday at some point with his father. Then it became possible to just think, well, an incident on his own where he's applying that kind of ferocious curiosity.
And you also make it quite an embodied experience as well, which is always a fantastic way of drawing the reader into the story.
Because of the peeing, you mean?
Because of the peeing, and yeah. Immediately he's located at the first sentence, he's hot with itchy grass seeds sticking through his socks, and that's yes. something that yeah. most children have experienced one way or another. And the line that struck me was the fact that he's aware of this intersection of 52B flight paths.
Yes.
And that was just, it jolted me straight into this consciousness.
His way of looking.
His way
yeah.
of looking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted a combination of the extreme physicality of a child, yeah. because I think all your senses are much more alert, you know, and the heat and the itching and the smell mm. and, you know, and the fascination with the smallest detail. You know, the fact that when you pee, you know, it does make a little yeah. crater. I mean, once you start to take yourself back into childhood, you start to remember those things.
Yeah.
And I think, for me, developing character in a short story particularly is partly about finding the places in my own experience that I can extrapolate from and build on. I have to believe it. Mm. And in order to believe it, at some level I have to have experienced something that I'm building on. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I've written about characters that murder people and so on. I mean, I've written about things that I have not done. But the point is that you need to find the moment in your own experience where, you know, there's been a murderous rage that you mm. can build on or whatever. I mean, that's... Otherwise it seems to be hollow, mm. I think.
Something that really interested me about the way you tackled the... I suppose the parallel lines, as it were, in the story of personal life, which is obviously a history in itself for Turing, mm. and then the science, which is something which can be so hard to communicate mm. to a reader in this context. You very cleverly weave them together, and you build them through time in a very deliberate chronological way.
Yeah.
And partly that feeds this sense of inexorability into the story, which is incredibly effective for a reader who knows the fate of Turing, but also for a reader who doesn't. It was, I suppose, a related question is, where a story like this involves so much research, how do you take care of the reader who may not have all the information?
Yeah,
and that's something I think that you do build into the form of the story, but I wonder how much you were conscious of that.
I was conscious of it because, I mean, I knew it was hard to understand, and as I say, I found it hard to understand myself. So I was looking for moments in the personal life that were moments of either extreme highs or lows of emotion, or moments, you know, or this moment in childhood, moments that it would be very easy for the reader to empathise with. Because I think, and that's why I've used the sort of personal and the scientific stories, you know, in parallel, one incident of each at each point. Because if you're thoroughly empathising with the character, even if you intellectually cannot fully follow what he is thinking, and I mean, I cite the opening of his paper on morphogenesis, and it's hard. You know, I'm not a mathematician, and most of my readers aren't. But if you are empathising with the character, then I think you can get close enough to thinking you understand, or to giving a sense of it, for it to be okay and for it to remain impressionistic, but for you to know, to feel that you've had a bit of contact with that great mind as it pursues its course. I mean, the whole thing of scientific explanation has dogged me rather, because in my last novel, yes. The Testament of Jesse Lamb, obviously there were intricate scientific explanations, both of the you know, the virus that is killing all the pregnant women in the world, and of the ways in which it can be cured, and it is scientifically plausible. And so I went through this in great detail, but then of course I put it in great detail into a book, and it's deadly dull, and no one wants to read it. And you have to find a way of conveying the reality of it without burdening the reader with detail. And I mean, I wish I knew a quick way to do that. I don't. All I know how to do is to write it all and then cut it and cut it and cut it and cut it.
Yeah. And the little experience I've had of working with research, you can reach a stage as a writer where you forget what it's like to be the uninformed reader, I think, which is quite a dangerous stage to be at. Mm. And you almost have to unlearn, perhaps,
Leaving a gap always helps with that, I find. Mm. If you write something that's burdened with research and then, you know, you leave it for a month and then you come back and read it, it screams at you, you can see exactly what's wrong.
Yeah. Yes, time is is such a help. So Hitting Trees with Sticks was a story that, by the sounds of it, almost wrote itself.
Yeah.
But did that come from the same sort of personal impulse, a point of relation to the subject matter?
It came, I see it as having come from two very specific starting points. The first of which was that I did see this girl hitting a tree with a stick.
Which is great.
Which is precisely as I described it. You know, it was completely surreal because it was, in this grass verge on this big dual carriageway where a child or a young person would not be standing. And she had a broom handle and it didn't have a broom on the end, but it was a manufactured stick. And she was just regularly beating this tree. It was completely bizarre. The image just stuck, as such an image would. And so there was that. I had that, and it just worked in my mind a bit. And I thought she's hitting a tree with a stick, and then I thought that's a great title. There is a title in there. But the other starting point for the story was that a very good friend of mine was spending quite a lot of time looking after her mother, who had developed Alzheimer's.
Right.
And she told me a few little snippets about her mother's disorientation and her behaviour. And in particular, she laughingly told me of a condition which is apparently known to medics, which the doctor had described to her as being called squirrelling behaviour. And squirrelling behaviour is when the sufferer from Alzheimer's takes a possession which is important, let us say her keys, and hides them somewhere so that she will be able to find them, but she hides them somewhere illogical and then she can't find them. Mm-hmm. I use that in the story. She hides her keys in the bread bin, and then, not only that, she wraps them up and she can't find them. But I just found that notion of squirreling behaviour, it's so logical because, now, hopefully with a reasonably clear mind that's not affected by any kind of onset of Alzheimer's yet, I know that I put things in specific places so that I will be able to find them, and that I cannot always find them, and that I very often have the very distinct memory of having put them somewhere safe.
You know, it's somewhere really special.
It's human. It's human. Yeah. We all do it, but to push it over the edge into that little bit that's actually mad, and sad, it just kind of took me into. Okay, someone with Alzheimer's is not a mad old person over there. It's a person whose world is just becoming increasingly annoying and strange.
The strangeness.
And it's getting into, it's putting yourself in that place rather than looking at it from the outside. That's the glory of fiction. You get into somebody's head and then it all looks different.
And the sense, something I found incredibly moving with that story is this constant tension, which you set up very carefully and very deliberately, and it builds throughout as this gradual unravelling reveals itself to the reader, the unravelling through memory loss. But the tension at the heart of the narrative is partly to do with competing narratives. So this woman trying to normalise the situation she's in and trying to justify through creating her own version of a new narrative in which she's not the one who's losing her memory, but other people are getting things wrong.
Yes.
And it's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking.
But it's what we all do all the time, isn't it?
It's what we all do anyway.
You know, all the things that go wrong are generally other people's fault.
Well, it's also life in general, the idea of life as competing narratives, the fact that we all spin our storylines the whole time.
Exactly.
It's one word against another.
Exactly. No, I mean, she's writing fiction. She is creating a fiction of that day as each episode. She says she's been shopping. Her shopping cannot be found anywhere. So then, what are the alternatives? Has somebody stolen it? Has she put it somewhere safe? Maybe she didn't go shopping. And at different points in the story, she believes each of those different narratives, just as you would test out. So it's a fun thing for a fiction writer to do, because you're writing a character who's making up her own, as you say, making up her own story.
Mm. And of those two stories, I know that one's experience of writing a story can be very, very different. Which would you say you enjoyed writing more,
Hitting Trees.
Hitting Trees.
Definitely. Because I mean, it's so great when a story, you know, when you've got the voice in your head and you can just write it. I mean, and that's quite, you know, most stories I write involve an awful lot of chopping and changing and cutting and carving and false starts and so on. So it's a joy when one just arrives.
One of those rare, glorious moments.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But with Morphogenesis, there must be a sense of satisfaction when you've wrangled with something as complicated, where you've been blending a deeply personal and tragic story of a suicide with very detailed scientific facts.
Mm.
And I don't know if you were working to a brief as well, but I know that can change the dynamic.
It had to. The brief was simply that it needed to be a story which, at the heart of which, was his not discovery, but his description of morphogenesis,
mm.
which obviously is a scientific concept which has gone on to be important since his death.
Mm.
So that was the brief, but I could treat it in any way I wanted, and yeah.
What was so interesting about the way you developed the personal life alongside the science was you were exploring the idea of his growing sense of his sexuality,
yeah.
alongside his research question,
mm.
and the two almost urge each other on.
They urge each other on, and I mean there are questions obviously of you know, what is fated, what can we choose, how far, mm. you know, how far can we determine ourselves and how far are we predetermined,
mm.
I mean, which is articulated within the story, but it's, I mean, that, you know, that seemed to me to be a key question, particularly for a man, you know, who is told as an adult that his sexuality is you know, disallowed,
yeah.
but it is him, it is the core of him,
yeah.
so he is disallowed, and so that, you know, there was an obvious sort of furrow to plough in that.
I think we can move on to talking about the collection as a whole,
mm.
And maybe a little bit about what it's like putting a collection together, the ordering of stories.
Mm.
When you're having to, within a story, you're already juggling so many elements. What is it like to create the sort of juxtapositions? And
I found it really, really hard. And obviously it's my only collection of short stories. I find short stories hard. I've written 8 novels and I've got one collection of short stories, so you can see I don't write that many. I mean, obviously the first thing that you decide is the ones that are not going in,
mm-hmm.
and that was decided in discussion with Ra Page, who edited the book, and he had very strong views on which of my stories were worth having and which of my stories were not, which is good.
Helpful and distressing in e-commerce.
Good. No, well, I mean, it's interesting. Mostly we agreed. There was one we totally disagreed on, though, and I did prevail, and it is in. He, the one that he doesn't like is called Kiss and Tell. It's the one about the writer who doesn't have an affair with a politician.
Oh, okay, yes.
And he was very against that one, and I was puzzled because I kind of thought it worked, and I actually did, you know, I did test it out on a number of other readers before I said, look, you know, other people think it's all right.
It's going in.
Yeah, but he had ideas about the order, and I had ideas about the order, and we played with different concepts, like maybe going through the ages, so that you would start with young narrators and move forward to the older, because there is a complete age span in the stories, from a, you know, sort of 15-year-old girl, mm. to a very old lady. So that would have been one way of doing it, or just to do it in terms of, you know, maybe ones that are lighter and ones that are more serious. Or, I mean, you know, there are an infinite number of ways you can do it, but I became quite obsessed by the fact that I do use the first person a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And as a reader, I often get a bit nervy if I'm reading a collection of stories, if the writer changes narrative voice but is first person from one story to the next. Because it's fine if you read a short story and put the book down, but you know, if you carry on reading and you start the next story and it's a completely different first-person, mm. voice, there's always a bit of a hangover from the previous first-person voice, I find, if it's well-written. Mm. And so that troubled me a bit, and I thought, I don't want people, you know, feeling at home with this I And then it's another I, yeah. but it's a different person. So I thought, well, one way to do it is just to be very, very, you know, cut and dried about it and alternate first, third, first, third, first, third. And it so happened I had 10 of each. And in the end, that became a guiding principle. Ra felt less strongly about it than I did, but that became a guiding principle. And then we were playing around with, you know, length and variety and so on. Some of the stories also are... not recent. About half of them are recent and were written specifically because the collection was commissioned. But the other half are stories, you know, that I've written over time that have maybe been published here or there or on radio or something. So again, for me, I kind of wanted to mix them up and have the old and the new mixed together, not to have the old all segregated in one spot.
It's interesting thinking about short story collections in terms of the reading experience and what the reader expects, because so many people struggle with reading short stories anyway. And certainly in Britain, this is one of these devastating things to
it's
short story
It's what people
writers.
Say, but I mean, do they? I mean, I've never met anyone who said, oh, I can't read short stories. Oh, have you?
I've met a couple.
Oh, have you? Okay.
I shouldn't admit that on the Thresholds podcast, but yes. And I wonder how much... I mean, hearing you talk about... There's something very clean about saying, OK, we're going to have third person, first person, and it sets up a rhythm for the reader. And it's something I thought about in terms of the length of a story, that if you know a story is going to be 20 pages rather than two, as a reader, do you approach it in a different way? Do you think, I need a different toolkit?
That's really interesting, I think. I think that's a really interesting question. And I'll tell you where I really did puzzle my brain over that is the long story that's four separate voices, Where Are You, Stevie?
Yeah.
Which is actually the most... recent of, in the whole collection, and which I did kind of at one point think might develop into a novel. You know, I've got the four different women who all know this boy who's died, and each of them has her own take on him. And I did wonder whether that would be tough on the reader, if it would be a bit weird, because it's the only section of linked stories within the book, and they do kind of stand alone, but they feed each other as well.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of an anomaly. But how did you feel about that as a reader?
I felt completely taken care of, in as much as I needed to be,
right.
Because
the umbrella
was
title.
Clear. Yeah, the umbrella title. And I love stories like that. With that, I always think of it as the Rashomon effect, where you get these alternate perspectives.
They're fun to do.
Yes. Yeah, because it extends that writer's project of inhabiting one other person, and just it's sort of finding something more prismatic, I suppose, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, it's great fun as well, because of course the reader knows that he or she is learning more about the narrator than about the boy who's dead. But on the other hand, by the time you put all four together and you've got conflicting evidence, you have learned quite a bit about him.
I think that's a cow. Which is like the small wonder blessing.
I thought maybe it's still a phone that's been switched to silent, but it's got a terrible buzz.
That would be
a cow, okay.
A really rural ringtone.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, we've got a cow. Fine.
In terms of thinking about form and how much it matters... How much does it matter to you when you're sitting down? If a short story can be two pages, or it can be, I don't know, I've been told that a short story could be 18,000 words, then at what point do you think the distinction of form is kicking in by, I need to know, or do you simply set out knowing you're going to write a novel or a short story?
That's a very, very timely question now, actually, because... I'm struggling with it because I've mainly written novels, and obviously to put this collection together, I really, you know, got into a different gear and thought only about writing short stories, and now I'm trying to get back into writing another novel, and a bit of me keeps kind of carving it into short stories. There's something marvellous about the short story because you know so much is unexplained. And it's a completely different rhythm, a novel. And to move from one to the other is is difficult. I know there are writers who do seem to write very successfully at almost any length. I mean, you look at somebody like William Trevor, completely brilliant, writes wonderful short stories, writes novellas, writes novels, and it's almost as if he just, you know, the length...
He finds the length.
...fits his material, and there it is, it's perfect. I think I always have, on the whole, I have a sense of if it is a short story or a novel. But I'm not, you know, the thing of length is it's open. I mean, I've written stories, I guess the longest story I've written is probably about 15,000 words. I mean, I have written longish stories. I do tend to go on. The best discipline for me about short story is the forcing yourself to cut. Because I am naturally quite an expansive writer, I think, and I have always found that the more I cut, the better it gets. And if I could cut, you know, if I could go through this book and reduce it to half its length, it would be better. I know that. So writing the short story is an exercise in cutting. I think, you know, at the moment, as I said, I mean, I'm trying to work on this novel idea, and it keeps wanting. Part of it wants to resolve itself into short stories, and I think that's just because I've now got into the habit of thinking of the short story form. And I wouldn't say that I think of it as a very specific form, but it's more about wanting to deliver a single thing. I mean, obviously a short story tells you more than one thing, but there's usually quite a pure trajectory at its heart. There's one thing. And, you know, you find different ways of working with that. But that is so not a novel. And once you get into your head this notion of I'm delivering a limited thing, and in its very limitation is the point, like a poem is the point, because the reader, it should reverberate for the reader should find more, but it should be like a little closed circle, whereas a novel is a great long journey that you go on over hill and down dale. It's to do with the way that you're seeing it as you start writing it. And I think it... Well, I mean, as I said, I think I'm quite confused about it at the moment.
It makes sense to me that if you've been focusing on a collection, it's almost as if you develop certain muscles.
That's a good way of putting it, actually.
Yeah. Used to working in a certain way.
Yeah, that is a very good way of putting it. Yeah.
And I think the reverse is probably true with short story writers trying to write longer, which is learning not to edit and learning to relax and not to obsess about sentence by sentence progression quite so much.
Yeah.
And breathe out.
Well, you need to start seeing the big arcs of the story with a novel. And so it is very different. It's a very different thing.
So if you had to choose three things that would bring you back to the short story form in the future, as a form that you love, presumably enough to have completed a collection, what would they be?
The three things that I love about short story. I love the fact that you can finish it. You know, I mean, you can, you know, I wrote Hitting Trees with Sticks, that story, I wrote it in a week. I mean, you can finish it. When I write a novel, it takes me four blooming years, you know. So that's number one. That's great. I love the fact that you can actually, you know, in miniature capture a life or a world just as much as you can in a novel, if you get it right. And I'm not saying that I get it that right, but, you know, we look at the great short story writers. I mean, obviously, you look at Chekhov, or you look at Catherine Mansfield, and... Or Alice Munro, you've got, you know, all the meat and understanding of life that someone else will put in a novel in a short story. I love that distillation. That's amazing. But it's very, very hard to do. It's very hard to do. So, yeah, I can say more things that probably I like about short stories as a reader than as a writer. As a writer, I find them terribly hard. I like the fact that... sometimes you can explore worlds or minds in a short story, which, leaving a lot unsaid, which maybe you would feel very insecure about exploring in a novel because you would have to just give a lot more information.
That's very interesting.
And that's an interesting one because I mean, I am an obsessive researcher and I do research my novels hugely. And so, for example, I mean, I think probably the least well-structured story in this book, I mean, maybe you would agree or disagree, I don't know, but is The Disaster Equation.
I don't think
it's terribly well-structured, but what happened with that was that I just got very interested in this boat and this these characters on this boat. And I've never been on a yacht. I don't know enough about any of this stuff to write a novel. I could do the research. I mean, that would be probably easier than researching Australia in 1788. I could do it. I could go on a yacht. But the point was that I could do a small amount of research, enough to make a story plausible. Mm-hmm. And then I could get out there and have fun on the yacht and write the story. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense in which I suppose it's cutting corners a bit. Although I should never say that, should I?
Well, it's another way of putting it is it's just playing with the strength of omission and ellipsis, which is...
Yes.
These are strengths of the form that are a pleasure to toy with anyway.
That sounds much better. Thank you.
So you're not lazy. You're let off the hook. I wondered, because I know you teach as well, you're a professor of creative writing.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have any thoughts on self-consciousness as a writer, and also as a teacher, where awareness of a form becomes problematic, if you can become too aware of a form, too aware of what it is you're doing, or whether that's just absolute nonsense.
It's interesting. I think I put a very different head on when I'm writing and when I'm teaching. Mm. And I mean, sometimes I am shocked at myself, because there are various suggestions that I make to my students about when they're revising, you know, things to look for, ways to check, ways to think about the work to see how they could improve it. And these are generally very good instructions, I actually think. But what I sometimes find is that I haven't done them myself. Mm. And it's like I have to remember what I'm telling other people to do, because actually if I did it, I could improve my work. Mm. So I think there's quite a gap between the two. And I remember when I read Doris Lessing's autobiography, she was very forthright in that. She's very forthright in that about finding it very unhelpful to study criticism. Mm-hmm. And to fill your head with, literary critical terms and so on. Because as a writer, you need to figure out what you're doing and do it. You don't need this battery of... And I do completely agree with that. I think there's nothing worse than being terribly conscious of, the kind of thing that you're doing. And I mean, I've had students who've really, really struggled with that, really struggled with the fact that they've swallowed too much literary theory and they're almost trying to write a book for a recipe. And it's an absolute nightmare. Much better to be naive and ignorant and, pour something out that has some intent and meaning and then shape it. You can always shape things afterwards is what I've discovered. And I suppose that's a novelist's experience.
Yeah.
I write too much. I always write too much. And really, in all the novels, what I've done afterwards is carve it to shape. It's not a particularly... economical way of working. It's not. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but I think a lot of us do it, actually.
And it lets you work. It lets you keep on
working.
It
lets you work. It lets you flow. Mm. And then, so you write the thing that needs writing, and then you apply the critical intelligence, and then you turn into the nasty school teacher, and then you cut out all the best bits and turn the end into the beginning. But it's a different part of your brain, and if that part of the brain's operating from the beginning, it can really, really cramp you, I think.
It's the writer and editor.
It is, exactly.
And keeping them separate, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It was Jennifer Lahiri was talking last night, and she said something along the lines of, in developing, in those very early moments when you're developing a new character, you're jumping into that void, which is terrifying for any new project, it's not really the brain that needs to be working, it's somewhere else. And she didn't specify exactly where that was, but it made a lot of sense. And in terms of what you're saying, that it's not through that sort of rigorous critical thinker that you find your way into a story.
No, you use that afterwards, and quite often that will tell you that what you've written is pure rubbish. But, you know, that's okay.
But fine, yeah.
Better to write pure rubbish than to sit there being tongue-tied, unable to write anything.
Mm.
I think that would be the worst thing.
A related question, I'm remembering Alice Munro's comment about starting a story anywhere and how she doesn't necessarily have to move from the beginning to the end, but she, as a reader, she can jump around, which I find extraordinary, but that as a writer, she can do something comparable. And with novels, this makes a lot of sense to me, simply because they're so capacious. Mm. But with short stories, I find that very interesting, because so many of them do work on this idea of a trajectory, which is what you were describing earlier, the sense that everything's gathering.
Mm.
Even if you're dealing with multiple elements, they're all gathering. But do you, with a short story, would you start anywhere, or would you always start at the beginning?
I don't know, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, stories present themselves to your mind in different shapes, I think. I mean, for example, you want the story that's set in France is a loop, really.
Mm.
I mean, he arrives in Nîmes, he has a horrible time, and he travels back in memory. And in travelling back in memory, he reanalyzes something, which brings him back to the present, and he can kind of forgive himself then. So what you've got is a journey in that story, which actually ends where it began, but with a change.
Mm.
So that's not a story that goes in a line at all, whereas another story, The Shape of Another Story, Saved, for example, where she goes to move her grandmother's bed for her parents and ends up nearly running over a little girl, and then the little girl's all right. That's completely linear. Mm. You've got little bits of memory, but the basic structure is linear. And I think when I'm just kind of dipping my toes into the beginning of a story, I probably, somewhere in my head, have quite a clear sense of what that shape's going to be, of how it's going to twist and turn, or what sort of shape it's going to make.
Mm.
And obviously, I mean, memory probably comes into all of them, but, well, you know, with the Turing, for example, it's very chronological.
Yeah.
And I needed that, because you need to see him growing, and you need to see him inevitably moving towards his fate.
Yeah.
That's inherent in the idea of the story.
There's such a strong sense of predestiny. And,
And you see, hitting trees with sticks is another loop in a way, because she starts by seeing a little girl hitting a tree with a stick, and she ends up by hitting a tree with a stick herself.
Yeah. And those repetitions, or near repetitions, reiterations, I suppose, are something that really comes through in short stories, because of the compression of the form.
Exactly.
And it can be it can come with an uncanny sense of revisitation.
Mm.
That they're almost the same, but not quite.
That's right. Well, it's like music, isn't it? Mm. You modulate something slightly, and it ends in a different key, but it's the same tune. It's just,
Well, thank you so much. I think that's a good place to finish.
Thank you for lovely questions. It was really interesting.
It's been an absolute pleasure reading your collection, and thank you so much for taking the time out. I know you've got to go and speak to a whole auditorium of people.
I'm just going to read them a story. It's all right.
And I must also say a big thank you to the Charleston Trust for hosting our discussion at the Small Wonder Festival. So thanks, Jane, and thanks, Charleston.
Thank you very much.